Hello and welcome to iScience. My name's Greta Jackson and this fine evening I find myself at the Royal Society. Architecturally beautiful as this building might be, the main attraction here tonight is Professor Andrew Bamford from the Department of Zoology at Cambridge. In his new book, Wild Hope, Professor Bamford takes a new approach to how we view conservation. It's so easy to slip into the doom and gloom aspect of biodiversity, but there are so many success stories out there, and Professor Bamford has set out to show us the most inspiring of them all. I had a quick chat before his lecture began to pick his brains on various difficulties and problems facing 21st century conservation. Tell me about your favourite conservation success story, in a nutshell, more or less.
So probably the most interesting one that I looked at for this book is the extraordinary story of a mountainside in western Ecuador called Loma Alta. This is a place that's packed full of endemic, narrowly distributed birds found nowhere else on Earth, and yet for decades habitat loss there has continued. There's really been no great success. All of that was until about 15, 20 years ago, when an extraordinarily far-sighted conservation biologist who was there looking at the birds looked at what the trees around her might mean for the local people. And rather than seeing birds, what she saw was what this forest does in the dry season. During the dry season, it intercepts fog. And by doing that, it keeps the streams down below the farmers need in their fields. It keeps them running through the dry season. So she discovered with local people that these forests were essential for their continued livelihoods. And within 3 months of collecting those data and presenting them to the local community, they decided to declare a large portion of their area as protected and from any further land conversion. The result is they've still got their forest, they've still got their agriculture, and the birds have still got their habitat. But the key was seeing the issue not from the point of view of biodiversity for once, but from the point of view of local people.
So leading on from that, that sounds like to me like a more social conservation as opposed to a fortress method. Do you think social conservation is the only way forward and with expanding populations and so forth?
No, one of the other things that I learned from travelling around looking at successes for this book was the importance of a diversity of approaches, and it became pretty clear to me that one size doesn't fit all. There are different things needed in different situations, different problems, different actors, different threats. So for example, in Kaziranga National Park in India, the world's largest population of great Indian rhinos, which have been protected and managed to increase substantially, 100-fold in the last 100 years, really remarkable, but largely down to fortress and vines conservation, coupled with local people's desire to keep their rhinos. Those rhinos wouldn't persist in the face of heavily armed poaching were it not for strong-armed fortress and vines conservation with nightly patrols by armed guards. No rhinos persist in Asia without armed guards. In that situation, I think a fortress and vines approach is essential, although the notion that one size might fit all is illusory and probably damaging.
You mentioned, I think, in the introduction that there's so much doom and gloom literature out there surrounding biodiversity. But one thing that came to mind is that by writing about the few cases of success, are you not giving out a full sense of security, a full sense of hope?
I hope not. The book starts with a fairly gloomy overview of what's really going on. I think the situation is extremely dire. We've lost probably half of nature. We're losing what's left at probably 1% a year or so. The losses are grave and they're serious, and I wouldn't shy away from them. But on the other hand, Martin Luther King didn't say, "I have a nightmare." You won't get people, I don't think, to make necessary changes in their lifestyles, in their expectations of a good life and so on, without inspiring them that things can be turned around, that this can work.
How do you think you can justify spending so much money on, say, rhino conservation, as you mentioned earlier, in India, when hundreds of millions of people in that country live below the poverty line? How can you justify that spending when there are other very worthy causes?
So I think the key there is to appreciate the important values that we get from nature as well as the costs of conserving it. So I don't see investing in nature conservation as a cost. I see it as an investment. That's not the same as saying that any particular sector of society necessarily benefits, and I think often local communities might be worse off as a result of conservation, whereas in terms of many of those benefits that derive from conservation, particularly benefits to do with regulating the global climate, to do with the benefits we feel from knowing that there are still creatures like rhinos roaming the earth, those benefits accrue to the global community, people like you and I. And I think moving forward it's going to be extremely important to incorporate ways of us repaying local communities for their foregone opportunities as part and parcel of paying for conservation, but in an equitable way.
Thank you, Andrew. All the best with your talk tonight and your book, Wild Hope. You've been listening to me, Greer Jackson, on iScience. If you want to find out more about Professor Bamford's book, Wild Hope, you can find a link below. Thanks for listening.